We focus on keeping bees healthy, and this ranges from breeding bees for resistance to diseases and parasitic mites to big landscapes that have lots of blooming flowers over the whole growing season.
Another MacArthur Fellow, jazz pianist and composer Jason Moran. His work combines historical influences with his own ideas. The foundation has also made grants to NPR. Paul Brown, NPR News.
Record high temperatures in parts of California have prompted officials to post red flag warnings for fire danger and left thousands of people without power. The mercury hit a record 113 in Los Angeles yesterday and were above triple digits in Anaheim to Santa Cruz and Salinas on the usually balmy Central Coast. Pam Coulter, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Citgo, recognizing the difference everyday heroes are making in communities nationwide. Learn more at fuelinggood.com.
Help us expand the community of WILL contributors. The Fall Pledge Drive kicks off with a Power Hour Wednesday, October 20th. Your gift now to the Member Match Fund will encourage others to follow your lead and help keep the Pledge Drive short. Send your check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the executive producer of HBO's new series Boardwalk Empire, Terrence Winter. He seems to have an enduring fascination with New Jersey gangsters. He used to write for The Sopranos. Boardwalk Empire is about gangsters controlling the flow of booze through Atlantic City during Prohibition. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons. Today we have the pleasure of having a conversation with Barbara Demick, the author of Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. I'm delighted to have Ms. Demick with us today, especially on this historic day. Actually, we don't have Barbara Demick with us today, so we're going to run an archive broadcast from Focus 580. Thank you for your patience.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, in for David Inge. Wes Moore is a businessman, author, and decorated Army veteran. It was a struggle, however, coming up. With the help of others, he made it. There is another Wes Moore. He, too, had a rough time as a kid. Today, he's serving a life sentence for the murder of an off-duty police officer in an armed robbery. Their stories, the two stories of Wes Moore and Wes Moore, are told in the book The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. The book is, at the end of the day, a call for action. In the book's afterword, Tava Smiley urges, once we read the book and take in its implications, that we create a plan to act and make a difference. Smiley calls it leaving a legacy. This morning, we'll hear about the story of two individuals in their lives, why one succeeded and one did not. We'll also talk about the possibilities for getting involved. Author Wes Moore is our guest. He's a businessman, author, and decorated Army veteran. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Wes Moore served as a U.S. Army captain in Afghanistan. He worked as a White House fellow, a youth advocate. He's currently working as an investment professional in New York. His book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Faces, is published by Spiegel & Grau. And you'll find him online at www.theotherwesmoore.com. And you'll find a link at our website, will.illinois.edu, W-I-L-L.illinois.edu. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Wes Moore, good to talk with you this morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to talk to you, too, Celeste. Thank you.
When and how did you become aware of the other Wes Moore?
It happened years ago. I was actually in South Africa on a study abroad program while a student at Johns Hopkins University, and my mother and I were on the phone, and she said, I've got something crazy to tell you. She said, there are wanted posters all over your neighborhood. I was living back in Baltimore. She said, there are wanted posters all over your neighborhood. The police are looking for a man wanted wanted for the murder of a police officer, and they're looking for Wes Moore. And that was how I first became aware of the other Wes Moore. But then when I came back to the United States, I started learning more about this case, and this was a case that really gripped my city and gripped Baltimore and gripped the state, because the person that was murdered that day was a 13-year veteran of the police force. He was a three-time recipient of Police Officer of the Year. He was a father of five who just had triplets, and the reason he was even working that day was because he was trying to make extra money for his family. And there were four guys that they were on the lookout for, and there was a 12-day national manhunt, and finally they caught all four of them. And one of the people that they caught was the other Wes Moore. But I realized how much more we had in common than just our name. The fact that we both grew up in single-parent households, the fact that we were living in the same neighborhood, the fact that we both had academic and disciplinary troubles growing up, the fact that we were around the same age. I mean, all these factors really led me to, that really haunted me and led me to want to learn more.
Yeah, as you say in the book's epilogue, and it also appears on the jacket of the book, the chilling truth is that his story could have been mine. The tragedy is that my story could have been his.
Absolutely, and that was something that I realized. I mean, I've done over 200 hours of interviews with Wes and his friends and family, my friends and family, because I had actually known Wes for a while before I actually decided to turn this into a book. But there were really two things that really led me and drove me to want to turn this into a book. The first thing I thought about was the tragic death of the officer, and I said if I could do something that could help keep these tragedies from ever happening again, then I needed to do it. As Edmund Burke once said, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And I thought about something that Wes told me. When I talked to Wes about it, he said, listen, I've wasted every opportunity I've ever had in life, and I'm going to die in here. And if you can do something that can help people understand the ramifications for their decisions and also help people understand the neighborhoods these decisions are being made in, then I think you should do it. But one of the things I really realized was just how little separates us from another life altogether, and just how it's those small differences, it's those small interactions, those small conversations that really make the difference between a life going one way and a life going completely different.
He's been in prison now for 10 years. What's his life like?
His life is the same as it was 10 years ago. He'll wake up at 5:30 in the morning, and then he'll be counted, and then he'll go on to his breakfast, and then go on to work. And he works most of the day doing whether it be making license plates or carpentry work, and he makes about 53 cents a day. And at the end of that, he can then use that money towards stamps or things in the commissary. He'll get 1 to 2 hours of outside time, which is just time where you're allowed to leave the building and go out in the fenced-in area, in the fenced-in yard. And then he'll go off to bed and around 10 and then start the next day doing the same thing. And I make it very clear, though, that I say that not to make people sympathize or to glorify in mm-hmm. any way, but I say it because I want people to understand the consequences, and I want people to understand the ramifications for our decisions and what happens when we don't use critical thinking in terms of the decisions that we'll make.
Yeah. Well, just think of the repercussions for all the families involved.
That's right. I mean, you have in addition to the incredibly tragic death of the officer who did nothing wrong besides go to work that day and didn't come home. In addition to his tragic death, he had five children that are now growing up without their father. Wes has four kids who are now growing up without their father. Wes's older brother, who was actually the trigger man that day, Tony, had three kids. And so you think about the dozens of lives that were shattered, all the children and the widows and the friends involved in this by one action. And it really helps you to think a little deeper about all the actions we take and the ramifications for those actions.
Why did you want to get in touch with him?
Initially it was because it was out of pure curiosity. It kept on coming back to me. It was like, now how does this happen? How do two kids who have similar backgrounds and similar circumstances end up in two completely different places? And that's really what I wanted to explore. So there was a whole series of questions that I had for him that in retrospect are pretty naive questions. But questions such as, I knew Wes had children from the articles I read. So I asked him questions, do you ever see your kids and how are they doing? And I asked him questions about his brother. I said, how do you feel about your brother? How do you feel towards your brother? And so all these are different things that I just wanted to get answers to. And so I decided one day to write him a note. And I really wasn't expecting to hear back from him. I had no idea if he'd write me back. And quite honestly, it didn't matter that much if he wrote me back. I just knew I had to get these questions off my chest. And then a month later, I got a note back from Jessup Correctional Institution from Westmore. And that one letter turned into dozens of letters. And those dozens of letters turned into dozens of visits.
How did he respond to your first letter?
It was interesting because the first thing he wrote in that letter, he first thanked me, and he said, thank you for writing, because when you're in prison, you think the whole world doesn't think you exist anymore. And then he went on to answer all the questions, and it was honestly, it was in many ways his honesty, and more so transparency about and his willingness to talk that really amazed me, throughout this entire process. And so that was something I saw from the very first time that I reached out to him, because I think there was a lot that he wanted to say. And I think that he then saw my letter as an outlet to really start saying some of the things that he had on his mind.
In the introduction to the book, by way of explaining the connection you felt to him before you wrote that first letter, you quote from the book, Brothers and Keepers.
Yes.
And the book is about brothers, one who's on the run for an armed robbery. Do you feel that this relationship you've developed with Westmore, do you feel like he's a brother?
It's interesting. I took that the quote from the John Edgar Wyman book was when John Edgar Wyman's brother was actually on the run, and he wrote a brilliant book called Brothers and Keepers about it. I think that I've grown significantly from my relation from getting to know Wes. I think I better appreciate my life, and I better appreciate the people that were involved in my life throughout the process, and I think Wes does as well. I think this process has really helped Wes for really the first time really think deeply about his past, about his life, about the choices he made, and about his circumstances. One thing I say in the book is, as Wes was growing up, in many cases, actually for both of us in some cases, you generally don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about long term. And really, as Wes heard the judge tell him that he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison, Wes said it was really the first time in his life that he finally thought long term about what his life was going to be like, because he now knew that this would be his destiny, that he'd be there for the rest of his life. I mean, I can never forget the crime. I can never forget about the families that were impacted by this. But I do know that I think I have, I personally have grown throughout this process, and I think Wes has as well.
Mm. Here now, I'd like to have you read an excerpt from the book. This is the opening of the second part of the book. This is a scene where you've been visiting one another now for some time, and your relationship has grown. I was just stopped dead in my tracks by this exchange that you have in the book. Would you please read it for us?
Absolutely. Happy birthday. Wes gave me a half smile. Thanks, man. I almost totally forgot. As the rest of the country celebrated independence, Wes spent his 32nd birthday in prison. He's allowed to have visitors only on odd days of the year, so he was prohibited from seeing people on the 4th of July. I visited a couple days after his actual birthday. When I arrived at Jessup that morning, my eyes flickered up to the sign mounted above the institution's steel front doors. The name of the prison, Jessup Correctional Institution, inked in bloody crimson. I stopped walking for a moment and stood in silence. It was midday. Over the towers of the prison, the summer sun was high in the center of the cloudless sky. I looked up at the vast canopy of blue above, then took a deep breath, feeling the fresh air race through me. For the first time in a long time, I was reminded of the daily miracle of my freedom, the ability to move, explore, meet new people, or simply enjoy the sun beating down on my face. After going through the requisite security checks, I waited for Wes to walk into the waiting area. I studied the reunions taking place around me. One inmate, a young man seemingly in his early 20s, sat across from a woman with a baby squirming in her arms. He was apparently meeting his own child for the first time. His girlfriend complained that since the kid hadn't slept through the whole night since he was born, neither had she. Another inmate listened wide-eyed as his grandmother ran down a list of friends from the neighborhood, updating him on what they'd been up to since he'd gone away. He hung on her every word. When my conversations with Wes had begun years earlier, we'd said only what we thought the other wanted to hear, what the other needed to hear. But over time, it was hard to keep up the act, and our conversations drifted towards an almost therapeutic honesty. When did you feel like you became a man? Wes asked me. a troubled look on his face. I think it was when I felt accountable to people other than myself, when I first cared that my actions mattered to people other than just me. I answered quickly and confidently, but I wasn't too sure of what I was talking about. When did I actually become a man? There was no official ceremony that brought my childhood to an end. Instead, crisis or other circumstances presented me with adult-sized responsibilities and obligations that I had to meet one way or another. For some boys, this happens later, in their late teens or early 20s, allowing them to grow organically into adulthood. But for some of us, the promotion to adulthood, or at least its challenges, is so jarring, so sudden, that we enter into it unprepared and might be undone by it. Wes, feeding off my answer, attempted to finish my thought. Providing for others isn't easy, and the mistakes you make trying are pretty unforgiving. He paused. I waited. He rubbed his chin, softly pulling at the long strands of his goatee with his fingers. And second chances are pretty fleeting. What do you mean? From everything you told me, both of us did some pretty wrong stuff when we were younger. And both of us had second chances. But if the situation or the context when you make the decisions don't change, then second chances don't mean too much, huh? Wes and I stared at each other for a moment, surrounded by the evidence that some kids were forced to become adults prematurely. These incarcerated men, before they'd even reached a point of basic maturity, had flagrantly and tragically squandered the few opportunities they'd had to contribute productively to something greater than themselves. I sat back, allowing Wes's words to sink in. Then I responded. I guess it's hard sometimes to distinguish between second chances and last chances.
Hmm. Second chances and last chances.
Yeah.
That's Wes Moore reading from The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Wes Moore, our guest, is a businessman, author, and decorated Army veteran. But it was a struggle coming up. With the help of others, he made it. And there is another Wes Moore. He, too, had a rough time as a kid, but today he's serving a life sentence for the murder of an off-duty police officer. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also have an email address. You can send a question or a comment to us by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So how did your correspondence with Wes Moore turn into activism?
You know what's interesting is that I've always been involved in community service and community outreach. I think it's just been a part of who I am, whether it be it was my time serving in Washington in the White House or serving with the 82nd Airborne Division in Afghanistan or serving communities that I've lived in. But this process has really added a sense of clarity and has really emboldened me to want to really get involved, because I think by exploring my own life, I realized the potency and importance of just one person deciding that they want to make a difference. And I realized that importance because I see it in my own life. I realized just how slim those pathways were that I took, those tentative steps in the right direction. And had it not been for people involved in my life, had it not been for my mother and my grandparents and aunts and uncles, but also just role models and mentors and friends who had taken it upon themselves to make sure that I walked the right path, my life could have been very different. And that's one reason why I've taken this level of activism so seriously. And even in the back of the book, probably part of the book that I'm most proud of, is in the back of the book where there's a resource guide of over 200 organizations that are on the ground doing the work and really working to make sure that that lives are changed and communities are altered and showing us that we can all make a difference.
Hmm. Yeah, as I mentioned in my introduction when we began this morning, your book ultimately is a call to action.
That's exactly right. It's really, one thing I didn't want for this book is for people to be able to pick it up and say, wow, that's an interesting story, and then throw it off to the side. This book really is a call to action. This book is showing us, what are the ramifications of either our attention or our apathy, of either our concern or our indifference. What I believe that it's done is also shown people, and this a lot of the YMs have been so humbled by the feedback and by the response, is it's showing people that this book is about so much more than just these two kids. It's about so much more than just Baltimore. It's about so much more than just one socioeconomic group. It's about all of us, and it's about the choices that we make and the people we have in our lives who are helping us to make those choices and what the ramifications for those choices are. And that's what's been so inspiring about the response.
Yeah. One of the things that concerns me is the number of kids who don't finish high school. And you came close to that yourself. Your mother had to take a drastic step to get you through school. What can we do to get involved there and make a difference there?
Well, it's a great point, because I think, you know, it is really one of the great tragedies that we have got to confront in this country, and not even just the lack of success rate in just in K-12, but also K-16, because when you think about where we are as a globe in the 21st century, we cannot continue to be satisfied with some of the rates of the graduation rates that we see, you know, within so many of our country, because in many cases, if you show me a high school dropout, you're also showing someone who is. You know, has a much, much higher likelihood of also then being involved in the prison, you know, in the prison industrial complex and as such. So the way I think we need to address that is, A, looking at the way we completely structure our education system. You know, I think school reform is something that needs to take place, and being able to keep up with whether it be longer school hours, longer school days, being able to really give our teachers the resources that they need in order to do the job correctly, making sure that we have a holistic approach to education, that we're really bringing families involved and parents involved, because I think that's really going to be part of the main foundation of how we're going to, you know, increase educational standards inside of our country. And also just this idea of higher expectations. There's a point in the book when Wes and I are talking, and I asked him, I said, do you think that we're products of our environments? And he looked at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations, which I thought was a great point and an important distinction, because if the expectation of you or the neighborhood that you live in is that you'll end up finishing high school and finishing college and you'll go on to become a successful husband and father or mother or wife, then that's generally what kids will do. But if the expectation of you or the community that you live in is that you probably won't finish high school, you'll probably be involved in the juvenile justice system, and you'll probably be involved in the larger revolving door of the adult prison population, then that's generally what kids will do as well. And so I think there has to be not just a physical change in the way we approach school reform, but also a psychological change in the way we approach the expectations that we have for so many of our kids in the neighborhoods that they live in.
You founded an organization called STAND. It works with youth in Baltimore who are involved in the criminal justice system. What kind of work does the organization do? How do you reach those young people?
Well, I actually started STAND back when I was a college student at Johns Hopkins. And really what I wanted to do was I was actually taking a class called Criminal Justice and Correction. And one of the things we had to do for the class was actually work within some element of the criminal justice system. And because of my childhood and the fact that I had my brush-ins with the law and I was getting in trouble growing up, I knew that this was a population I wanted to work with kids and show them that there are second chances and there are other things they could do. And when I realized that there weren't really organizations that focused on that, particularly on that population, I decided that I wanted to start one. So I got together with a group of friends of mine, and we started STAND, which stands for Students Taking a New Direction. And we work with kids, generally first and second time offenders, who are involved in the juvenile justice system in Baltimore. And really what we did was we'd work with the mayor's office and also with the office of the juvenile defender's office in Baltimore, and work to identify the kids and also work with their schools to identify the kids, and then work to mentor, befriend them, and tutor them to also just show them that they're a part of something bigger. One thing I know, and my mother always says, and I think it's a very important point, is kids need to think that you care before they care what you think. And what we really tried to do was show kids that we show, you know, our young people that we care, and that their vested interest is our vested interest, and their destiny is our destiny. And I think by doing that, you're able to see a light really go off, in the hearts and the imaginations of so many young people you work with. Because what you find for so many young people is they're just looking for acceptance. They're just looking to be part of something bigger than themselves. And if we're not able to provide it to them in a positive angle, they are people who will provide it to them on a negative angle, and that's exactly where we don't want them to go.
Yeah. And so often when you're at that age, all you can see is right what's in front of you.
That's right. You see your block or your city or your neighborhood, and that's all that you see. So if you can actually do something to open up their horizons and show them that there's something bigger out there, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, I think that was a major transition for me when I started to become accountable for my own actions, when I started to become responsible for my own actions, when I started to understand leadership, and I started to understand that there was more out there as long as I was just willing to hold on, that there was more out there waiting for me. I think that's when I really started to better appreciate the process that I was going through.
Mm. When and how did you realize that there was more out there?
I think part of a big turning point for me was actually when I got sent away to a military school. And I'm very clear that for me, military school was a tremendous point in my life, not just because of the physical change, me being taken out of the Bronx and being put to Pennsylvania, but it was a psychological change that took place. That was probably the most important change that happened in my life at that time. But this was a place that when I first went there, I hated it. I literally ran away 5 times in the first 4 days from military school. But after the last time I ran away, my chain of command had actually drawn me a map on how to get to the train station I kept on looking for, and eventually I realized in the middle of the night that the map was fake, and they led me out to the middle of the woods just to go get lost and become terrified. And they then led me back to campus, and they said, you're allowed to make one phone call. Call who you want, but you have one phone call to make. And I called the only number that I knew, which was my mother. And I told her, if you let me come back home, I'll do better, and I'll start going to school more, and I'll do whatever you want me to do. And she stopped me. And she said, too many people have sacrificed in order for you to be there. And too many people are working hard in order for you to be there. And your father's looking down at you, and he's proud of you. And he just wants you to give it a shot. And I think at that point, it didn't happen overnight. But at that point, I started to understand that I was a part of something bigger, that my existence mattered to more people than just myself. And that's when I think that transition started to take place, and I started to take it seriously.
Yeah. You call your mother the rock of the family.
Yeah.
What else would you like us to know about her?
My mother is just she is just one of the most diligent, not just parents but people that you'll ever meet. And I think my mother made it very clear at a very young age, something I think is very important for all parents to make clear to their kids, is she made it clear to me that she's not my friend. She's my mother. And she said, you've got enough friends. And I think it was a tough thing to kind of go through that process of, but I think it was incredibly important for me for her to take that stance, because you know what so many kids need are parents. They're not necessarily friends. Now to this day, my mother's still one of my best friends. But I think that transition happened later in life. That transition happened mm-hmm. when she was able to kind of pull off the reins a little bit, and when she said, you know what, I think he's gonna be okay. He's gotten all the background and all the training he needs in order to live out life successfully. And now that's when I think our relationship made a transition. But she was a stalwart supporter of us, even, and she saw things in me that I didn't even see in myself growing up. But she was always there for me. But she was always there to be a mother and not necessarily just to be a friend.
Yeah. One woman who I knew many years ago, I've never forgotten what she said, but she said, raising children, you've got to understand your shoulders are wide and your back is strong. You've got to, you know, you're not a friend, I think was her point as well.
That's right.
You're not friends. When your child is an adult, a man, a woman.
That's right.
Then the relationship changes.
Then it alters. And again, to this day, I mean, like I said, my mother to this day is still one of my best friends in the world. I talk to my mother, you know, consistently, and she means the world to me. But she knew that, you know, for me to make that transition successfully, for me to become the adult that she knew I could become, it meant for her to make tough decisions. And I think that was very important for her to really do that, particularly because she was on her own. And she realized that as hard as she worked, it's how hard that we would all work. But my mother spent her whole life making sacrifices for us. And my sister, I think, said it best when she said, my mother wore sweaters so we could wear coats. And I think that, you know, my mother has just, she devoted her life to making sure that we were going to be okay, despite challenges growing up.
And she learned how to be a parent from her parents.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And my grandparents, my grandfather is actually from Jamaica. My grandmother was born in Cuba, and they met in Jamaica and actually had all their children in Jamaica. My mother was born in Jamaica as well. And decided to move to the United States. My grandfather decided that he wanted to join the ministry and wanted to become a minister, and actually later on became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. And so my grandfather came to the United States to become a minister. My grandmother came to the United States to become a school teacher. And she, my grandmother was a school teacher in the Bronx public school system for over 25 years. They made it very clear about their role as parents. And that role took on increasing importance even after my father died. I watched my father pass away when I was 3.5 years old, and my mother's having significant difficulties in dealing with that, and now dealing with out of nowhere, all of a sudden and instantaneously and unexpectedly, here she was now a widow with 3 children. And so her parents, my grandparents, said, "Listen, if you know, come back and move back to the Bronx with us, you know, we can make do." They had a small home up in the Bronx. So even though adding 4 more people to that home was going to be difficult, they were like, "We're going to make do, and we want to make sure that you're going to be okay and that the kids are going to be okay." And that's my mother, a few years after my father passed away, that's exactly what they did, and we moved up to New York.
Yeah. What a loss for your mother and you and your sisters. What do you remember most clearly about him? Who was he?
He was just an extraordinary man. He was calm. He was disciplined. He was loving. He loved his kids. I only have 2 memories of him. The first memory was when my mother got mad at me for hitting my sister. And one of my mother's big pet peeves has always been hitting a woman. And I think a lot of that was from her personal experiences. She'd been in abusive relationships, prior to my father. And so when she saw me even at 2 and 3 years old, trying to, fighting my older sister, she would not tolerate it. And that's something she's always been very clear about. And I think that one time I tried to hit my sister, I did hit my sister, and my mother happened to walk in the room and saw it, and she sent me up to my room, and I was running upstairs to my room because I was so scared. But I still at that point I wasn't really old enough to understand what I did so wrong. And then my father came up to my room, and he opened the door, and he sat me on his lap, and he started to explain to me what I'd done so wrong and why it was important to protect women and not fight them, and why my mother loved me. She just wanted me to do the right thing. And he walked me downstairs to go apologize to my mother and to my sister. And I remember looking up at him and just feeling, just trying to imitate his walk and trying to imitate the way that he was striding down the stairs. And he was my hero. And then the only other memory I have of him was when I watched him die. When I was 3.5.
Yeah. He was a journalist.
He was, yeah. He was a journalist down in the Maryland and Washington, D.C. area. And he actually was suffering from something called acute epiglottitis, which is basically a swelling of the epiglottis. And the epiglottis sits over our windpipe, and every time we breathe or talk, it allows air into our body. And his essentially became so swollen that it sat on top of the windpipe, so essentially his body suffocated itself. And he went to the hospital, and the hospital released him and told him that what he needed to do was just get some rest. And then a few hours after he was released from the hospital, he was walking down the stairs, and I remember running to the stairs to go see him so he could pick me up as he got to the bottom of the stairs. And then I watched him collapse. And the first responders came quickly, but by the time they got to him, by the time they got him to the hospital, it was already too late.
Yeah. As the story begins in this book, The Other Westmore, you're visiting Westmore in prison, and you ask him if he thought his life would have been different if his father had taken an interest.
Yeah.
How did he answer the question?
He said something I thought was very interesting. He said, "Listen, your father wasn't there because he couldn't be, and my father wasn't there because he chose not to be. So therefore, we're going to mourn their absence differently." Which I thought was an incredibly important point, but I think one thing that Wes and I both also agree with is that hole that's left for so many kids, and particularly young boys who are left without their fathers, is so significant that in many cases you'll find young kids, and particularly young boys, who will try to fill that hole in many ways unproductive and also dangerous ways. And I think it led to a lot of the mistakes and a lot of the confusion that Wes and I had and the mistakes that Wes and I made as we were growing up.
Yeah. Well, for Wes, his brother, his older brother, Tony, mm-hmm. tried to fill that role.
He did, and it was interesting because Tony played a fascinating role in Wes's life. Tony, and not unfamiliar than many cases of older brothers who are doing the wrong thing and are trying to steer their younger brothers in the right direction. But Tony hadn't made it past eighth grade in school. Tony was involved in the drug game in Baltimore ever before his age even hit double digits. And I think that, you know, Tony, as he started to see Wes started to fall down this track, he was trying to do everything he could to try to keep Wes away. He would tell Wes, he'd say, listen, you're not built for this. That you're too smart. You can do something with your life, but you don't need to follow my path on this. But Tony, being one of Wes's only role models and one of Wes's, you know, biggest role models, really led, his example was really what Wes was hearing and not necessarily his words. And so I think in a rush to be more like Tony, Wes started following in a lot of those same footsteps. And, you know, it's interesting because Wes looked at Tony and saw everything he wanted to be, but Tony almost looked at himself and saw what he didn't want his brother to be. And that's why I thought it was a fascinating dynamic between Wes and Tony as they were growing up.
Yeah, two kids who didn't see that second chances could be last chances.
That's right, and how thin that line can be sometimes between second chances and last chances. Because when we're children, we think that second chances will always come. We mess up and people give us a second chance and it's not a big deal. But it's amazing how jarring that distinction becomes when those second chances become last chances. And in many cases, you're completely unprepared for it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Wes and Tony's, I don't know, is Mary Tony's mother?
She is, yeah. Mary's Tony's mother, but Tony is Wes's half-brother because they have two different fathers.
Okay. Well, reading about their mom, Mary, I was saddened to see her opportunity for a college education put out of reach.
Yeah.
And when she told Wes that she had to drop out, he offered to get a job.
Yeah. That's right. At five, 6 years old, he offered to get a job. You know, that was really one of the heartbreaking things about this is, you know, one thing I try to be very clear about in the book is, you know, this is not a story of good mom, bad mom. You have two mothers who both care deeply about their children. Two mothers who wanted the best for their children. But I think the amount of leverage that they had around them and their ability to actually reach out and utilize that leverage was where you started seeing some distinctions. Mary was the first one, as you correctly pointed out, Celeste, Mary was the first one in her family to go to college. I mean, she graduated from Baltimore City Community College and then was accepted to Johns Hopkins University. And when the Pell Grants were cut and when she was no longer able to go to school, she then could no longer finish. And I can't help but think how her life could have been different had she actually completed her degree from a school like Johns Hopkins, and not just about the piece of paper that she would have received, which has been incredibly important, but the networks and the connections and the friendships that she would have made there, which would have been crucial to her life trajectory, and not just to her life trajectory, but also to the trajectory of her children. And so I can't help but think how her life could have been altered had she had the opportunity to finish her degree.
Yeah. How and why did these two kids get swallowed up by the streets?
Partly because I think in many cases, particularly for kids who grow up in precarious environments, it's extraordinarily easy. You have environments where they are almost actively working against parents to try to make a difference and to try to help their children navigate throughout this process. I think the concept of expectations become extraordinarily important, and because of external expectations, but because external expectations in many cases become our internal expectations. I think that when you have situations where you have young people and you have single parents who are working and who are stretched so thin, and you have so much idle time for children, it becomes very challenging for them to navigate this process. So I think when you have that confluence of all these factors playing into it, a school system that in some cases around our country is graduating at barely over 50% of their students who start. As long as you have that as a dynamic, it becomes extraordinarily difficult for kids to see what their role is in this world and what is their larger point in this larger dynamic of life.
Yeah. You could see this happening when Wes begins to smoke pot.
Yeah.
And soon, you know, he's wrapped up in drugs, the allure of drugs, both as a way of getting high and of making money.
Yeah. That's right. And where you also see it, too, is after Wes had been involved in drugs for a while and he had the opportunity to go to Job Corps. And Wes will openly say, he's like, you know, Job Corps was one of the most important and been one of the best opportunities of his life, where he had a chance to really remake his identity. And he left the Job Corps, you know, really motivated, and he got his GED from the Job Corps. He found out he was reading at a sophomore in college reading level. And he really wanted to go and try to do something different. And he went back out, and he was working a whole collection of different odd jobs that were paying him, minimum wage or barely higher than minimum wage. And he thought about back to the days when he was making thousands of dollars a day selling drugs, and he made the fatal decision to say, I can't do it anymore. Wes at that time had four kids. He had two mothers of his four kids who needed support. His mother needed support, and Wes decided that it was better for him to just go back to the streets to go make the kind of money that he was making before. And again, ended up becoming not just a fatal but a completely unforgiving decision that he made. But that allure to make money and provide for, at that time, his children became very important for him, which also goes into the challenge of having kids at such a young age. Wes became a grandfather at 33 years old, so he's currently a grandfather. So that becomes a challenge also, the added pressures when you're taking on the responsibility of taking care of others when you're not even an adult yourself yet.
Yeah. How are his children faring?
They're doing okay. I think, you know, they're having many of the same challenges that a lot of kids have who are raised in households. And not in the case of two of Wes's kids, are being raised by their grandmother, by Wes's mother, Mary. So I think, you know, and you look at just statistically, nationally, the kids of the incarcerated are seven times more likely to become incarcerated themselves. So I think this process in many ways has actually helped them in some ways, because I think it's helped for them to understand their father a little bit more in ways that they never understood him before, by being able to examine his life a little bit, and also helping them to really understand the ramifications for their decisions and help to keep everything in context.
Have they been able to stay in school?
They have been. They have been. All of them are still in school as of now and all in the process of being on pace to complete. So they're actually, and again, Mary, Wes's mother, is now, kind of helping and supporting a lot of them as well. But, you know, you have now Mary, who, in addition to taking care of Wes's children, or at least some of Wes's children, she's also helping to take care of Tony's children, Wes's older brother, who was also incarcerated for life for the murder of Sergeant Prothero, and who just recently died in prison a few months back. She's also now has another son of hers, who she's taking care of, and also she's taking care of one of her nieces. So Mary, who's now a great-grandmother, is also now has that burden of taking care of all these other children as well.
She has to be a rock, too.
She really does, and to talk to her, you know, I know she's, you know, and it's interesting because I think, you know, she looks at it and she says, she openly admits, you know, a lot of the mistakes that she made when she was growing up, and she had her first child when she was 15. She had Wes when she was 19. So she openly acknowledges some of the mistakes that she made growing up, as all parents do, because no one does it perfectly, and everyone's going to make mistakes during that process. But I think that she says, and she said before, is that in some ways this process almost makes her feel like she has a second chance to do it right.
What's the response been from that family to the book?
It's been fascinating because I think they appreciate the fact that in some way, despite him spending the rest of his life in prison, that in some way they hope that Wes's life can make a difference in the lives of others and help them to understand their decisions and the ramifications for their decisions. When I first started this process, they were actually very reluctant because I'd known Wes for a while beforehand. But when, I remember when I, in fact, when I was first speaking to Woody, who's one of Wes's friends who I highlight in the book, I first asked Woody questions and say, "So Woody, tell me about school." And he's like, "It was fine." And that was it. And then I'd say, "So Woody, what was it like growing up in Baltimore?" "It was cool." I mean, he wasn't giving me anything at all. And then literally I got a call one day from Woody on a Thursday. And he said, "Hey, Wes, what are you doing on Saturday?" And I said, "Nothing. Why?" And he said, "I talked to Wes, and he said you're a good dude. And he said you're just trying to help some kids. So I want to show you some stuff." And then we spent all day Saturday kind of going around different blocks and different neighborhoods and going over a lot of things that him and Wes got into. And so it really took Wes kind of urging his family and friends to be transparent, that I was able to actually get the information and corroborate all the details that I was able to get in order to tell the story correctly.
And what does Wes think of the book?
Wes really had two reactions to the book. He read the book months ago, actually before it even came out, and he had two reactions to it. He said, you know, first reaction, he was amazed at how much research went into it. I literally did over 200 hours of interviews with Wes and his friends and family and my friends and family just to make sure I was really getting the facts and the feel right. But his other reaction was, he said after reading about his life in a book, it amazed him how little that he's done with his life. And those were really his two reactions.
Yeah. And there's nothing really he can do with his life except live it day to day. It's the same over and over. He has become a devout Muslim.
Yes, yeah, he found Islam, and initially he actually started going to Friday services because it was the only chance to see his brother. At the Friday services was his chance when he could actually get together with his brother, and so initially that was his main motivation for going. But he says, but through there, and he actually felt like he learned something, learned a greater truth, and so that's now the route that he's taken and he's gone down.
What about the Prothero family?
Yeah, well, there's some members of the family, to include the widow, who has said they will not read the book, and I completely understand and respect that. I saw the pain that my mother went through when she became a widow, so I completely respect that. But there are some members of the family who have been very supportive of the book, and they've read the book, and they said that they not only think it's a nice tribute to Bruce and to Sergeant Prothero, but also they believe it's a good way of helping to keep these tragedies from happening again. And I've been very clear every time I get a chance to say it, that there's no endorsement that means more to me than an endorsement from a member of the Prothero family. They're just, in everything that I've learned about Bruce, and I've done hundreds of hours of interviews on this, he was an absolute hero. Again, a three-time recipient of Police Officer of the Year, someone who was a man of character and integrity and faith, and I want people to know who we lost that day and why it's so important that we do get involved and do get engaged inside of these situations, because again, we lost a real hero that day.
Yeah. At the end of the book, you include a listing of more than 200 organizations that are out there doing this work. Reaching out, making a difference. Would you tell us about some of these groups you call Elevate organizations?
Absolutely. These are groups who have made it a point to support the lives of children, who have made it a point to support the lives of families and of communities. There are actually two organizations in particular that are receiving a significant portion of all book proceeds for the sale of this book. One is actually an organization called City Year, which was started in Boston, but it's a national organization that helps to give young people a year of public service, a year of something bigger than themselves. And there's another organization called the U.S. Dream Academy, which is a Maryland-based organization, but that's actually a national organization that actually works to support children of the incarcerated, so kids who have one or both parents who are currently behind bars.
And so many of these organizations would be linked to organizations across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever people are,
absolutely,
they can find an organization.
And that was very important to me that we have a list of organizations all over the country, because and also not just national organizations, but also local organizations in this area. And so why having, again, and the fact is, we have over 200 organizations here listed, and that really just scratches the surface of the amount of people that are out there doing the work. And that's why it was so important to me to highlight, because one of the frustrating things I heard was from people saying, well, there's no one doing the work. There's no one out there, focusing on these issues. And that's just fundamentally not true. There are literally thousands of these organizations around the country who are doing the work. So the question is, how do we identify them, and how do we provide them support, and how do we scale? And so what I really wanted to do was have people, so whether you're looking to help or whether you're looking for help, these are all organizations who would love to hear from you.
Yeah. And you've broken down types of organizations from advocacy to tutoring.
Absolutely. Yeah, because there's so many different ways to get involved, and what I wanted people to understand is that there's so many different ways and so many different avenues and so many different time commitments. One thing I firmly believe about public service is that public service does not have to be an occupation, but public service should be a way of life. It should be something that we all do. Because I think if we're all willing to do a little bit, we can make a huge difference in the lives of those around us and in our lives, because we're helping to shape the communities around us. And so I wanted people to understand is that if you want to get engaged, there's so many different ways to get engaged, there's so many different ways to get involved, and it's important that we all do it.
Yeah. There's a ministry in our community called Salt and Light, excuse me, Salt and Light. And there was an article recently about them in the newspaper, the local paper. And one of the things that struck me in that story was there's a family. Families actually get out there and volunteer to help in with in the food pantry and in the area of getting clothes organized and that kind of thing. And the parents of these children said, this it has been so tremendous for us because we can, all of us can make a difference.
Yes.
And we're teaching our children that this is something we need to be doing.
I hear stories like that, or I see the, you know, I was down in Gaithersburg, Maryland, a few weeks back, and there was a mother and a son who came up to me, and they said, we're reading your book together. And we've decided that when we're done reading the book, we're going to discuss it. And then we're going to go to the back of the book, and we're going to find an organization, and we're going to go volunteer together at the organization. You hear things like that. You hear stories. I received a note from a 14-year-old kid who's been in and out of the juvenile justice system growing up, and he said one of his older friends made him read the book. And he said it was the first book that he'd ever read cover to cover before in his life. But he said how this is, and he took the time to write me a note to say how this is the first time that he's ever really thought deeply about the type of man that he wanted to become and about the kind of difference that he wanted to make. You know, you hear those kind of stories, and you just know that the importance of the message, the importance that we all get involved, the importance of engagement, because we really can help shape, you know, shape lives as long as we're willing to do it.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here pretty quickly. Anything you want to leave us with at the end here?
Well, one thing, if people want to learn more, I think, you know, if you can go to the website, which is just www.theotherwesmore.com, and you can learn more about the work that's taking place around the country, learn more about the book, you know, biographical information, pictures and such. And I just encourage people to do it, and I encourage people to get involved and to really take a vested interest in the lives of others around us, because one thing I hope this book really does help to illustrate is how little separates us from another life altogether, and how we can really make a genuine difference as long as we're willing to get engaged and get involved.
Yeah, and I would also recommend this book for, I don't know, middle school kids.
Yeah.
I think it would be a great, you know, be a great book club kind of project for kids and parents, and then also it's worth its weight in gold for the resource guide.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It is, you know, it's been so humbling seeing the response that we received to the book, you know, thus far. You know, the book is now, is, you know, 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and to think about how you know, how it's able to touch people. And again, this book is about us. It's about our society, it's about our communities, it's about our country. And about much more than just these two boys, and I think that's the point that people are really getting, which I've been so inspired by.
Okay. Wes Moore, thank you so much for talking with me this morning.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Wes Moore is the author of The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. The chilling truth is that his story could have been mine. The tragedy is that my story could have been his. The Other Wes Moore is published by Spiegel and Grau. And again, the website, www.theotherwesmoore.com. More is spelled M-O-O-R-E. And at the website, you'll find the resource guide. So do check it out.
And you've been listening to a program from the AM 580 archives. It's 68 degrees in Friends Plaza, an hour of news and information coming up next.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from noon to 4 in the Bouvon's Tasting Room. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com or at 337-7704.
And in a minute before 12 o'clock, we'll now have an update on the numbers from Kansas City. Hard red winter wheat for December at 725, down 14 and 3 quarters. March at 740, down 13 and 3 quarters. In Chicago, December wheat 690 and a half, down 16. March 736, down 13 and a half. December corn, 506, down 6 and 3 quarters. March at 518 and 3 quarters, down 6 and a half. November soybeans, 1121 and a half, down 7. January, 1130, down 8 and a quarter. October soybean meal, 307, down 440. October soybean oil, 4043, up 25 cents. October live cattle at 9732 and a half, up 7 and a half. September feeder cattle, 110, up 12 and a half. October lean hogs at 78.25, down 90. And frozen pork bellies for February at 108.50, unchanged. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10.838, up 20.